Welcome to Steppin' Out, a reality radio show where you'll hear true stories of inspiration and transformation and substance abuse and recovery. It's like a 12-step meeting on the air. So sit back, grab a cup of coffee, and listen in. Because if you've ever wondered what happens in those 12-step meetings, you're about to find out.
Hi, and welcome to Steppin' Out Radio. I'm your host, Denise McEntee, and today we're going to be sharing a story of somebody who's a legend, who overcame adversity in his life. Each week, we share different stories from people who have overcome different issues in their lives or lives of family members, or, you know, we all have something in life, as they say. And today we're honored to have on Steppin' Out Radio, as I said before, a legend, and his name is Sam McDowell. And as those of you baseball fans out there would know him as Sudden Sam, Sudden Sam was a professional baseball pitcher. He played in Major League Baseball for years. He's very tall, 6 feet five, powerful, and his left-handed fastball was delivered with such an unusual calming pitch that they nicknamed you Sudden Sam. So without any further ado, I want to welcome Sudden Sam to Steppin' Out. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Denise.
Thank you. And really, on this radio show, we begin at the beginning because it's people that have overcome, and we've had stories from people from all walks of life, from sports celebrities like you to CEOs to lawyers. But what we all have the common thread is we start at the beginning. You know, how did it start for you?
Well, basically what we're talking about is a couple different things, primarily alcoholism that basically ruined my baseball career. But at the time, obviously, I didn't know about it, or I wouldn't let it destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was no different than anybody else in that the denial, which is so strong, carried me through destroying my baseball career, as well as my marriage and my family and everything that I ever had. In fact, ultimately, I ended up at one point sitting on a curb with 35 cents in my pocket, wondering what to do, where to go, or how to go about doing whatever. I had a possibility, and this is when I was sober, and I had a possibility of doing one of two things, either going and get a hamburger because I hadn't eaten all day, or I could have gotten some gas so that I could go make a sales call the following day to make some money, because, as I said, I had nothing. And at that point, I chose to take 35 cents and put gas in my car for tomorrow that I could have gone without eating. It wasn't a big deal to me at the time.
But can you tell us how you got to that curb? Can you started in baseball. You obviously, you know, unique in that you're... Yeah.
That's the ironic part. In most cases, you know, you read about an individual started drinking when he was a teenager and just let it carry on through. But in me, although I was an alcoholic, had the alcoholic personality and all the alcoholic traits, in my particular case, I used it the opposite to get attention. And what I mean by that is I did not drink throughout high school, even though all of us guys would go out after a football game, baseball game, basketball. I played all sports, lettered in all sports in high school. And I was the exception. I would not go out and drink with the guys. And same thing for me going to school. I never missed a day of school in my entire life, both through grade school and high school. And it wasn't because I wasn't sick, but it was because I got more attention. By going on with school and putting in my time, as it were. But all throughout the minor leagues, I did not drink. First of all, I wasn't old enough, even though I could have gone out drinking. But I signed at such a young age, at 17 years old, that for 4 years, I was not able to legally drink. And I didn't, only because to me it kind of got me the extra attention that I desired, and so therefore I never did it. It wasn't until my second year in the major leagues, back in my day, they never talk to you as a rookie coming up until you earned your way onto the team. And at that particular time, I hadn't earned my way. I was brought up primarily as a publicity deal because I was the largest bonus ball player that ever signed a contract with the Cleveland Indians. So periodically, they would bring me up from the minor league just to put on a show.
Mm-hmm.
And see what I could do. And then, of course, I wasn't able to do very much at that time, so I would go back to the minor leagues.
Mm-hmm.
And this went on for 1.5 years. But my second year in the major leagues, I was asked to go into the ball game in the third inning because our original pitcher got knocked out. I proceeded to pitch from that point on a no-hitter. And we had won the game, and when the game was over with, two of the veteran ballplayers had asked me on the team to go out to dinner with them, which to me was just like the skies opened up. because up until then, people didn't talk to you. People never went with you to dinner, never went out with you. As I said, being a rookie, you had to earn your way. And so we went to, and I still remember to this day, Diamond Jim's in Chicago. Which is used to be a world-famous steakhouse. And I went with two ball players. We sat there and had dinner, and how it started was I would have whatever they were drinking.
Mm-hmm.
One guy was drinking some kind of a fancy drink. I would order one of those, and then the guy across from me on the other side was drinking scotch. I would have one of those. And so that's the way it went. And then when dinner was all over with, they went back to the hotel, and I was just getting wound up, and I went out and proceeded to get drunk. My very first time at drinking. And this is the way I kind of progressed throughout baseball. And for my 14 years in the major leagues, I was a controlled drunk, so to speak. And what I mean by that is that on the day before and the night before that I was to go pitch, as a starting pitcher, I could predict it, I could plan it. I would not drink. I would not do anything. I'd just make sure I had my vitamins and made sure that I ate a proper meal and got a minimum of 8 hours sleep and everything, thinking that was going to cure me and everything was going to be okay, and never understanding the mental breakdown that alcoholism has with a human being. In my particular case, it exhibited itself by way of a know-it-all, a big shot, a guy that kind of couldn't be told anything. And this was throughout my whole major league career. And Sam McDowell always had a better idea. But it was compounded because I also ran into managers who arguably I was considered as having the hardest fastball in the history of baseball, and therefore a lot of the managers thought I could get away with just throwing fastballs, and it didn't work. But I would get my butt killed, and I would be sent back to the minor leagues because they were calling all my pitches, even though I had four major league pitches, fastball, curveball, changeup, and slider.
Mm-hmm.
And every one of them was considered to be the best there was in baseball at that time.
Wow.
But I wasn't allowed to use them. I had to go with the old-fashioned way of simply throwing fastballs until I get ahead of the hitter, and then go ahead and mix in some different pitches.
Was that frustrating?
Extremely frustrating, especially knowing that major league hitter, I don't care how hard you throw. You throw too many in a row to certain individuals, they're going to hit you.
Because
they do make adjustments. That's why they're in the major leagues.
I do this show week in and week out, and I've done it for years. And most people, like you said, have drank in middle school, high school. You didn't really take your first drink until you went out with two major league players, which you were excited about. I know you got drunk that first night and you remembered it, but what was the feeling when you did drink? What made you keep drinking? Did it give you confidence? Did you like it, obviously? Or, you know, what was that feeling?
Actually, to an alcoholic, when you do put alcohol into that bloodstream, our system works a little bit differently than a normal human being.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that the alcohol goes directly through the upper intestines into the bloodstream and goes through a total different change in the body. In our particular case, it makes us feel happy, it makes us feel intelligent, it makes us feel now like we're one of the gang, it makes us feel normal.
Mm-hmm.
Where up until that point, we never feel normal. And I know throughout my career and throughout my life, I know that when I was a child growing up, I never felt normal. I always felt like the outsider. I always felt like, you know, people were looking at me, and that one of the things that I know that really affected me more than anything was the fact that I didn't find very many things in life funny.
Mm-hmm.
I know that other people would tell jokes at parties or what have you, and everybody in the whole place laugh, and I just couldn't see the humor in it.
That's funny, actually.
And that that actually bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
And
because I think a lot of the reason I'm laughing is it sounds simplistic, but it's a common thread. Like everybody's laughing and you're on the outside looking in.
Right.
Right. So I'm sorry for interrupting, but
That's okay. That's okay. In fact, when you do drink, an alcoholic or drug addict takes his drug, what happens is we transform into that normal person.
Mm-hmm.
What we mean by that is we now actually do laugh, have fun. Find the humor in a lot of things. In fact, we even find the humor in things that are not funny.
Uh-huh.
because there's no way that an alcoholic or drug addict can maintain that finite line between now being normal and then going overboard with the alcohol or the drug in order to now go into stupors or whatever.
Right. And before the break, though, you were telling us that you were controlled, though. You know, you drank a lot, but you were always controlled. You didn't drink before your games, and, you know, you took your vitamins, but yet there was a frustration. So tell us what happened in that point in your career. So you were able to pull it together.
Yeah, I was, actually, I never pulled it together.
Well, but
that's the problem. In my particular case, as I said, I was extremely frustrated because managers would call my pitches, and then I'd get killed out there on the mound, never being able to pitch my way or the way I thought I should pitch. And lo and behold, I'd be sent back to the minor leagues and then brought up later on because when I'd go to the minor leagues, I had nobody there to help me. And I would pitch phenomenally. To give you an example, the one time I was sent down to the minor leagues in Salt Lake City, I pitched two games, a no-hitter and a one-hitter, and I had a total of 34 strikeouts. In the two games. And so the general manager called me out and said, well, we can see obviously that you're not learning anything in the minor leagues. It's too easy for you there. So we're going to call you up here to the major leagues, which when I come up, the managers go back to calling my pitches and what have you.
Mm.
There's a combination factor in here that is rather complex that I'm not going to really get into. But in part, it was Sam McDowell with the alcoholic personality and managers truly trying to help me, teach me how to pitch, but it wouldn't work because I was that alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't understand what the heck they were trying to teach me or how they were teaching me and so on. But then I came upon another manager, which was brought in, Alvin Dark, which the whole world opened up to me then. And when I say the whole world opened up to me then, I became a major league pitcher from that point on.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at my record, you can see that was the year that I started breaking all the records. And
now it's amazing, the records that you broke.
I'm doing all the pitching, but at the same time, things changed in which he brought in a pitching coach who would sit with me on the bench, and I was allowed to go pitch and do whatever I wanted to, but when I would come in between innings, he would explain to me on what I did wrong, how I didn't set up that hitter the way I should have, how I didn't set up this hitter, and so on. And it was very helpful, and then I would be able to go out there and do it my way, so to speak, even though it really was their way, but the right way. But I would think it was my way, and so I just took off from that point on. As to meaning the controlled drunk, was that, as I said, I never would drink basically two nights before I would go out to pitch and get myself in shape, do extra running and do extra calisthenics and what have you, getting ready for that next game. Then I would go pitch, and that night was mine.
Mm-hmm.
and every manager knew it. I even had managers threaten to fine me if I would go out after I would pitch, and I told them, I'll pay you in advance because I'm going. And they knew it, and finally, they, being the drunk that I was, I eventually got them to cower under and come in with my program. And so they found out that the more I was left alone, the more I would win, and so they would just let it go.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically in baseball, winning is everything. And I went along like this now for, as I said, for the 14 years until getting near the end when I started getting traded to the Giants. I had hurt my arm the year before, and I tried to get our team physician and what have you. But back in those days, you're kind of considered a coward if you came up with an injury. You had to play hard, drink hard, as it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so you really never complained of having an injury. You tried to work it through. Well, later on, many years later, 3 or 4 years later, I found out I had torn my rotator cuff.
Wow.
Back when I was with Cleveland. Didn't know it then, and neither did our team physicians, because, one, they didn't have any idea as to what was going on in those days and how to prove it like they do today. And we all knew that the minute you mentioned rotator cuff, your career was over.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas today, they can fix it like it's child's play.
Sure.
In fact, I'm in business with a doctor that does just that stuff right now.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, I went on like this with the Giants, trying somehow, some way, to figure out how to pitch. And the only way it worked out was if I could get 5 or 6 or 7 days rest, then I could go out there on a mound and pitch and last for about 7, 8, 9 innings, depending on how many pitches I'm throwing. And then, of course, I would tear it loose again, the muscle, and now I'd be done for another 4, 5, 6, 7 days until it started to heal back again, and then I could do it again. But it doesn't work that way in baseball. You're going to pitch every fourth day, one way or another, with what they're paying you. So you basically have to tough it out, and then it finally reached a point where I just couldn't pitch.
Just to even hear you talking about playing through all these injuries, but how did your baseball career end? Because obviously it did come to an end, so how did it end?
Well, basically, I got thrown out of baseball. I had reached a point because of the injuries now and the fact that I could no longer control my drinking because I wasn't a starter all the time with the teams. They were all getting fed up with me, and so they kept trading me to each team. And I eventually went from the Giants to the Yankees and then on to the Pirates. And Joe L. Brown, who's the general manager of the Pirates, knew of my history because he was in Pittsburgh and I lived in Pittsburgh. And, of course, I had a reputation there to the point where the minute I would walk into a bar, they'd say, no, no, Sam, not this one, not this one.
Mm.
Because I always want to fight.
And, and you're 6'5", so
yeah, I'm 6'5".
It's not good for business.
So
go ahead. So you would walk in. And
so anyhow, Joel Brown called me in the wintertime, and I asked him if he could give me a job, and he said, well, not really, Sam. I know you got a problem. And he said, if I find out that you've got a problem and you're going to continue on with it, I wouldn't even give you a chance because you would ruin everything on the team for everybody else. And I said, well, don't worry about that. I can take care of that. And he says, well, I'm not going to give you a contract. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and take you to spring training. I'll pay you for being in spring training. And we're going to leave and go north with the 10 best pitchers that show in spring training what they can do. And he said, but I will tell you this. If you start drinking, you're done. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, deal, no problem. Well, I went to spring training, and as luck would have it, whatever, the luck of the drunk is I had better statistics than any pitcher in spring training. In fact, I didn't give up any runs, no matter what they put me in. And they tried me at every different position that they possibly could, as a short reliever, long reliever, as a starter, and so on. And I succeeded in every facet of pitching. So about 2 weeks before spring training is ready to leave, Joel Brown calls me in the office and said, Sam, we're very proud of you, what you did. We're going to to go ahead and sign you to a contract. You did behave yourself. But he said, remember, during the season now, he said, the minute you start drinking, that's it. You're gone. I said, okay, I understand. And he said, in fact, you told me what you wanted to earn before if you could make it. And he said he's going to keep it to his word, and he signed me to the contract. Although he was unaware that there were periods of time in spring training that I did go out drinking and get drunk. But he didn't know about it. A drunk is pretty sneaky most of the time. We can always tell good stories, too. Most people know the minute we open our mouth, we're lying. But with Pittsburgh, I went ahead and started, and the season with them, I was not a starting pitcher, which I was capable of doing right now because I had literally 3 months of rest where my arm was healing up. But for whatever reason, I was in the bullpen, and I stayed there and just filtered in and out periodically when they needed me and succeeded. In fact, when I eventually got released, I was leading the Pirate pitching staff in all other categories. But we had gone to L.A. on an off day, and I got some close friends out in L.A., and we all are drunks. In fact, what's ironic is we're all recovering now.
Well, that's good.
Which is ironic. But I went out there and I proceeded to get drunk. And the next day for the practice, I didn't show up. And so when they called the room, I answered the phone. And I told them I had the flu, that I was sick and vomiting and what have you. And I couldn't leave the room, which was not true. But I'd already missed, as I said, as a drunk, you're a good liar. And so I was able to play the game out there for 3 days, staying in the bedroom, never leaving. Then when we were on to San Francisco, I went with the team. In fact, the first day there, they brought me in to see what I could do, and I shut out the Giants.
Wow.
Then we went on from there, and the end came rather subtly. We went into New York playing against the New York Mets, and we had a pitcher at that time that was starting the game, and he got knocked out in the first inning. I came in and pitched a shutout for the rest of the game, and a rather phenomenal one that I had. I numerous strikeouts and no runs, and I think only two hits and what have you. But to make a long story short, I won the game. And then, being in New York, I went out and tied one on. And the next morning, I showed up at the ballpark drunk. And nobody said a word to me, which was kind of interesting. That moment, I knew something was up. But nobody said a word to me. And then the next day, we go to Philadelphia. And they had me pitch there, too, after running me for 2.5 hours. for whatever reason. But on a plane flight coming back home to Pittsburgh, halfway through the plane flight, Joel Brown walks to the back to go to the men's room, and he leans over to me and says, I want to see you in my office in the morning. And so I knew the gig was up. And so I did go in there, and he said, Sam, there's no need for us to talk or discuss the whole thing. We had an agreement. I kept my word, and here's your release. And he, in fact, even said, to protect you, Sam, so you don't get abused, he said, we're going to just say that we wanted a right-hander. We need a right-hander instead of a left-hander because we're going to bring up a right-hander to replace you. And he said, that's it. Goodbye. And I left.
How did that feel?
That was it. I knew, as I said a couple of days before, that it was coming. And my way of thinking as a drunk now was just to scramble and to figure what I was going to do. But knowing in baseball that if you're released in the middle of the year, your contract, they have to pay you till the end of the year, I knew I had now 2 months of where I could do some heavy thinking and decide on what I was going to do. And ironically, when I got home, that afternoon I got a call from an old friend of mine, which was a teammate, when I was at Cleveland, and then a coach when he was at New York, and I was in New York, and then he became the manager of Kansas City, Dick Houser. And he had called me up and asked me if I was interested in playing for the Kansas City Royals. He's the manager, and he said, Sam, what we're going to do is send you to the minor leagues just to check everything out, and if everything's okay, we'll bring you to the major leagues. Well, I knew what that meant, and I knew that Dick Houser knew,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I was an alcoholic, a drunk.
Right.
And so, therefore, I didn't want that, so I just said, thank you, but no thank you, that's it.
Did anybody ever suggest to go get help?
No.
Mm-hmm.
Back in those days, they didn't know what to do. They had no idea how to control. They thought they could control an alcoholic, which obviously we know you can't.
Mm-hmm.
But they thought, and they kept trying every way they could figure it, the same way with my family. They would try everything from hiding the booze to whatever they thought was needed at the time to try and change a drunk's behavior, and it doesn't work.
And at this point, were you still married, and did you have children?
Yep, I'm still married, and I had two children.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, at this particular time, because of the headaches I was getting in the town where I was living, I had talked my wife into moving into a brand new house into another township where they didn't know me, and like what we call a geographical cure,
mm-hmm.
Which never works, but. You can't tell the alcoholic that. Anyhow, we built a brand new house, moved into the new township, and kids going to a different school and everything. And well, that lasted 1 year until my wife just said she had enough and she was moving out because there was no telling when I was going to come home drunk or what.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, in my particular case, I was fairly intelligent, so prior to this, I had, in the wintertime, since I didn't have to work, I was making enough money,
mm-hmm.
I would go to school and get every license known to man. I had licenses as an investigator for insurance companies. I
wow.
had insurance licenses, real estate license, security licenses, because I didn't know what business I was going to go into, but I was preparing myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went into eventually. The insurance business, and as luck would have it, with a drunk, I was setting all the records for the insurance company, and this was I was an independent salesman. The reason for that was I didn't want anybody telling me what to do, and I was willing to pay, get paid on commission only on what I do, because I had a lot more faith in myself than I should have, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I set all kind of records with the insurance company that they're still standing even today.
Wow. All through it all, how did you manage your alcoholism?
Well, as I said earlier, my wife and family had left me. They just couldn't take it. And even though I was making money, even though I was still around with them, nobody knew when I was going to come home sober or drunk or whether I was going to kill somebody in a car or what. And so they had left. And when they had left, I kind of just had periods of time in my life where I thought about what I was trying to do and how. And I knew there was something wrong. I didn't know what it was, but I knew there was something wrong. And eventually I went to a rehabilitation center in Pittsburgh, Gateway Rehabilitation Center. And I didn't even know what that was all about. It's just that I had a mentor at the time that told me to go there.
Mm-hmm.
And he happened to have been a psychiatrist. And a very good friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to the rehab, and then when I got out, he had asked me if I wanted to go back to school, and I told him that I might try going back to school, but now I'm in a position where I got to raise money for my family, for child support and what have you, because we had gone through a full divorce,
mm-hmm.
and the family needed my help to make some money for them, albeit very little. Because I tried to sell insurance, go back to school full-time, and still help out with teaching kids how to play baseball. And I wanted to go back to school because I couldn't figure this out. Me coming from a good Catholic family with a higher education and so on, I couldn't figure out how you could become a drunk being that. And so I did go back to school. And, in fact, I went off and on back to school for 6 years. And then I finally got a job with the Texas Rangers I got asked to come back because of the drug problem that was in baseball in the early 80s, 81, 82.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did go back to baseball, and I designed programs for baseball, which they're still using to this day. But for 18 years, I was the counselor on a team, EAP on a team, for both the Texas Rangers and Toronto Blue Jays.
Wow. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. And then during that period of time, I got a call from Joe Garagiola, who was the head of the baseball assistance team, which is the charity
mm-hmm.
of Major League Baseball, the only charity like its kind in professional sports. And they were having trouble with some attempted suicides or individuals that were right in the middle of attempting a suicide. And they had nobody that was trained in that area, so they had asked me to step in and take care of it. Which I did on two separate occasions, and both these guys, by the way, one of them is an ordained minister that works with children now.
That's great.
But he was one of the ones that was attempting suicide, and I had called him. But to make a long story short, for the past 27 years, I have been the counselor and consultant for the charity, the Baseball Assistance Team, in which we help anybody that is of the baseball family, not just baseball players, but their children, family members, umpires, front office personnel, secretaries.
That's great.
Minor leaguers, anybody. And we've been doing an unbelievable job of helping these people out. And it's just turned out to be the most enjoyable part of my entire life. You know, when you see somebody that's ready for suicide,
mm-hmm.
and turn around and work with them and get them to the proper people and then stay with them. And you see them start to smile after, you know, 2, 3, 4 months of therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And you see them starting to come out of it. There's nothing better in life than seeing that smile.
So out of something, you know, so hard for you, you turned it into something so positive. And gosh, just... there's a saying, I think it's in the Bible, that says, he who saves one life saves the world entire. And just to know the lives that you saved, you're right. I mean, a lot of people in life don't have that gift that they're given to save a life. So, you know, even though you were given, you know, some really hardships, being an alcoholic is not an easy road, that's for sure. And you were sitting on a, you know, a street with nothing, to save someone's life is a miracle. So what's your life like now? I know that you live in Florida, but what else is Sam's life like?
I'm still the counselor and therapist for BAT, and I still do that work full-time, but I also have put together a City of Legends down here, and it's a place where former players or athletes can come, and they have all kinds of help here. They got retirement deals for the players here. They also have medical facilities for them, psychological facilities for them, and so that they can also be with their own kind, so they don't feel all alone in society. And just as a closing remark, I can remember to this day, and it rings in my ear, with all the things that I did when I was a drunk, mm-hmm. driving off of bridges, driving into a river, I mean things where I should have been dead.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother used to always say, Sam, God has a plan for you. That's why he didn't take you.
Mm-hmm.
And now I know what that plan was.
Yes, you're sure it's a plan. But before we leave, and thank you for joining us, this story has been unbelievable. But I have to end on this note. They say the character of Sam Malone, the alcoholic ex-Red Sox pitcher portrayed by Ted Danson, was based on your life. Is that true?
Yes, it is.
From Cheers? Wow. How did that come about? Although we don't have time. You know what? We're going to have you back, and then we're going to hear that story. I'm sorry we don't have time, but I think that's great. And there was something that you said that was very funny about that you said that you would say that you're better with women than Sam Malone was. So
yes.
I just want to end with that. So obviously you know how to laugh now because you said everybody would be laughing and you weren't. So Son and Sam, thank you so much. And we're going to have you back, okay?
Thank you.
Okay, take care. Good luck. Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to Stepping Out. My name is Denise McEntee. Check us out on the web. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/Stepping Out. We'll see you next time. Thanks, everybody.